This is The Takeaway. I'm Nancy Solomon, a reporter in the WNYC newsroom, in for Tanzina Vega all week.
Secure, accessible, fair elections are worth the threats. They are worth the boycotts as well as the lawsuits.
Republican lawmakers across the U.S. have introduced more than 360 bills that aim to restrict voting rights. In Georgia, Republican Governor Brian Kemp recently signed into law SB 202, an election bill that has been accused of placing restrictions on voters after Democrats flipped the state blue for the first time in almost 30 years. The law reduces access to drop boxes, slims the absentee voting window, bars sending out unsolicited absentee ballots, and criminalizes giving food and water to voters in line. Its critics, including President Biden, have referred to the bill as
Jim Crow laws.
Civil rights groups and Democrats vocally opposed the bill, and corporations joined them. Georgia-based Delta Airlines and Coca-Cola said the law was unacceptable and based on a lie. And Major League Baseball decided to relocate their All-Star game from Georgia to Colorado.
In the middle of a pandemic, Major League Baseball put the wishes of Stacey Abrams and Joe Biden ahead of the economic well-being of hardworking Georgians who are counting on the All-Star game for a paycheck.
We've not asked corporations to take specific actions. When there are laws in place that make it harder, we certainly express an opposition to those laws.
In Texas, where a number of restrictive bills have been introduced in the state legislature, American Airlines has voiced their opposition.
My advice to the corporate CEOs of America is to stay out of politics. Don't pick sides in these big fights.
Senator Mitch McConnell retaliated by accusing corporations of behaving like a woke parallel government. And former President Trump has called for a boycott of companies that have spoken out against Georgia's new law.
Today, you don't even know what the hell you're watching. So I would say boycott baseball. Why not?
With me now is Nicholas Pierce, clinical professor of management and organizations at Northwestern University's Kellogg School of Management. Hi, Nicholas.
Hello. How are you?
Good, good. Thanks for joining us. And we also have Frank Garrity, an associate professor of history and African American studies at Columbia University. Thanks for coming on, Frank.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So, Nicholas, let's start with you. The actions by these corporations, what kind of pressure was brought to bear on them before they took their stand on these voting restrictions?
Many organizations are under increasing pressure to pay attention to what's taking place in the public square, and recognizing that remaining silent is no longer an option has thrust many of these organizations into ever faster, ever more decisive actions, such as the decision that Major League Baseball made to move their All-Star game out of Atlanta.
In response to the corporations taking a stand against restrictive voting laws, Senator Mitch McConnell said this.
My warning, if you will, to corporate America is to stay out of politics. It's not what you're designed for. And don't be intimidated by the left into taking up causes that put you right in the middle of one of America's greatest political debates.
Nicholas, what do you make of his statement?
I think that a true understanding of what politics are all about reveals that politics actually comes from the Greek word that refers to that which is of the people in the public square. Thus, any organization that has people in it has to concern itself with those things that are taking place in the public square that impact their people and their ability to make good on their mission and corporate objectives. Any type of action that an organization makes has political consequences, whether it is left-leaning, right-leaning, or fully centered. So I think it is a bit disingenuous and selectively beneficial for the senator to suggest that corporations stay out of anti-Republican politics, whereas he might be more inclined to invite them to participate in anti-democratic politics.
And how are the companies responding so far to McConnell and Trump and the Republican Party pushing back on them?
Some organizations that are trying to figure out whether they want to dip their toe in the water of equity and social justice efforts are probably thinking twice after that thinly veiled threat of political retaliation from the senator. However, those organizations that are well on their way in their diversity, equity, inclusion, and social justice journey will look at that comment as a thin veneer of threat that will not deter them from their commitments.
Frank, let's bring you in. I'm wondering how we should be thinking about this term woke corporation. I mean, does this have real meaning, or is it just an insult intended to gin up the Republican base?
I'm inclined to say that the latter is true, that this is rhetoric, right, from the leadership of the Republican Party, because these corporations are responding to, you know, the movement to reinvigorate democracy in this country, which has taken a variety of forms. One, the movement for Black Lives, which has highlighted the brutalization of Black people by police departments across the country. And then the grassroots movement to push back against this long history of voter suppression in places like Georgia and Texas and elsewhere. So that, you know, the corporations are responding to the movements in the streets, right? This notion that they're driving what's happening now in terms of pushing back against voter suppression is a mischaracterization. And I think that's consistent with what we've seen, certainly over the last year, where we've seen the corporate responses to the movement for Black Lives and a greater emphasis on promoting equity and inclusion in these companies.
Is boycotting something that we see from both the right and the left throughout U.S. history? I mean, the effective campaigns that come to mind tend to be, in my mind at least, tend to be progressive ones, like the Montgomery bus boycott during the civil rights movement or the fight against apartheid in South Africa. Is what we're seeing now from the Republicans, is that an outlier, or have they done this throughout history too?
I think it's mostly an outlier because the Republican Party, you know, throughout its history, and certainly, you know, since the civil rights era, and certainly since the election of Richard Nixon, has been firmly tied to corporate interests in this society. And what's making this moment interesting is that, you know, if you look at the Republican coalition since then, you know, three core constituencies have been corporate interests, have been the movements against desegregation in the South and elsewhere, sort of white grievance politics, and evangelical Christianity. And I think what the election of Trump has done is that it's sort of severed, you know, or destabilized this coalition, right? So that to be, you know, a supporter of the Republican Party, you have to go along with these movements that are pushing anti-democratic movements like what we've seen in Georgia and elsewhere, right? And the mythology around the 2020 election being a hoax. And so that's what's interesting about this time that I think is distinct, right? We're seeing a real destabilization, I think, in this coalition, which has really driven Republican Party politics. It's going to be interesting to see, you know, what happens as corporations will continue to sort of face this predicament as our politics remains polarized.
Yeah. I mean, there were so many times during the 4 years of the Trump administration when I think the prognostications were, oh, this is going to be the end of the Republican Party. They can't do this. And then they did, and it wasn't the end. So I wonder if this is another nail in its coffin or whether it's a reinvigorating move.
Yeah, you know, I'm hesitant to say that it's the end. Yes, a lot of people have been talking about the end of the Republican Party, and I'm not suggesting that at all, because we've seen how dangerously close they've become to establishing more authoritarian policies in our country, right? And they're still really very much about, you know, circumscribing the vote to ensure that they remain in power by any means necessary, and that's their number one policy objective, and stoking, you know, white supremacist, white grievance politics to pursue that goal. I mean, that's their fundamental goal, and if it means alienating corporate interests, it seems like right now that they're willing to do so. And I, you know, I think that, you know, even the whole discussion around Major League Baseball is interesting because there's plenty of precedents of professional leagues doing this before, right? Like when Arizona mm-hmm. refused to adopt the Martin Luther King Day holiday in the 1980s, the NFL threatened and then pulled out the Super Bowl from Arizona. And then once that was done, soon thereafter, Arizona adopted the holiday and the NFL brought the Super Bowl to Arizona in 1996, right? So this is not unprecedented at all in terms of professional sports leagues doing this, standing for policies that are really for democracy that most people want.
Nicholas, what do you think about this criticism that moving the All-Star game is going to hurt working people in Georgia because of the loss of income there, because of, you know, what a big driver that game would be for the economy?
I think it is certainly true that there will be small business owners and others who were looking to benefit economically from the All-Star game being in Atlanta. It's not only Major League Baseball and the players that benefit. There are hotels that benefit. There are restaurants that benefit, and a whole host of other workers who would stand to see a tremendous economic benefit. However, at the same time, I think that Major League Baseball is recognizing that they have to make a statement that is sufficiently bold and that is sufficiently swift to counteract the narrative that they are silently consenting to the infringement of voter protections. So it is challenging for workers in Atlanta, and at the same time, I do think the message has been received in the government of Georgia that Major League Baseball or other major corporations, as we've noted, are not standing idly by and will bring economic consequences to the state of Georgia, which ultimately will roll up to taxation consequences for the state.
Do you think it could hurt baseball because so much of the base of the fan base has been kind of white America versus football and basketball being more popular among the black community?
I do not believe that any backlash or retaliation against baseball will be long lasting or ultimately detrimental. I think that this will be a chapter in which Major League Baseball will come out looking on the right side of history, and they will continue playing baseball.
So, Nicholas, in general, how do you even gauge the success of a boycott, and how likely do you think if these boycotts really take off, how likely are they to succeed?
Sometimes it can be very difficult to ascertain the success of a boycott. I mean, I think if you look even historically at one of the most famous boycotts, the 1955 Montgomery bus boycott, that was such an integral part of the civil rights movement, it certainly achieved its goal as the Supreme Court ultimately struck down segregation in busing over a year after the boycott started. However, it was over a year after the boycott started. And sometimes the tale will be told in years, not days, and other times it may be in months and weeks. So it's very, very challenging to tell sometimes if we hold them all to the same metric. Sometimes it really does take a while to figure out whether such collective action has had its desired effect.
After the CEO of Georgia-based Delta Airlines said the state's new voting law was unacceptable, the state House Republicans there voted to rescind a $35 million fuel tax benefit. Delta is still holding on to the tax break because the state Senate didn't actually consider it before adjourning in the end. But that's a pretty big shot against the bow of a company, Nicholas, isn't it?
It is a pretty big shot. However, as Frank mentioned, the relationship between the Republican Party and corporate interests is long and well documented. Thus, it would be tantamount to shooting its own self in the foot. Any kind of retaliation of this sort, I believe, will be ultimately short-lived and will actually backfire if it is ever enacted. Some of this is more bark than bite.
Well, let's talk more about the history of boycotts in the U.S. There are many examples where consumers have been able to demand concessions, like the civil rights movement. So, Frank, tell us, you know, what has been the success or failures of boycott movements overall?
Yeah, just following what Nicholas was saying, boycotts have worked best when they are one of a number of strategies employed by a grassroots social movement, right? So, you know, the Montgomery bus boycott example is a great example of an ongoing Black freedom struggle that was taking shape yet again in the 1950s. and that the boycott issue, the segregation of the buses in Montgomery, you know, was just the issue that galvanized the movement in that state, right? And that it was successful, even though Nicholas is right, it took a long time for that victory to be won, but it was won a year later. The other example I think of course, is the Delano grape boycott, which was impelled by the United Farm Workers movement in California in the mid-1960s, right? Again, the boycott was one strategy of a number of strategies used by that union to beat back against the discriminatory and exploitative practices of the California growers, right? So when you look at the same thing with the anti-apartheid struggle, right? They're not successful when they're generated from the top, right? Unless you're looking at things like economic sanctions of one government against another, right? I mean, those things can have certain effects in terms of foreign policy. And so that's why I'm inclined to agree with Nicholas that this, I don't see this as having a whole lot of bite, the Republicans' efforts to sort of generate a reaction against corporate interests, because there isn't a mass movement against the restriction of the franchise in our country, right? This is totally a political calculus being made by the Republican Party leadership. And that's why I'm inclined to think that it will be like many boycotts efforts that have, you know, that are not an outgrowth of a movement. And I think that, in fact, it's this strategy is a reaction to the grassroots movement to reinvigorate democracy right now in our time.
So it sounds like you don't see this as having a lot of potential to shift public opinion. I mean, you know, it could move from Republican leadership to the base if they're able to successfully use it to build public opinion and build opposition to Democrats, especially, you know, in the, dare I say, we start talking about the run up to the midterm elections. So, I mean, do you see it having that potential to start to motivate their base?
It certainly could, just like the myths around the 2020 election could, which resulted in the disaster of January 6th earlier this year, right? So there's no question that this plays well to the base. But the base, is significant, right? It certainly is. I'm not trying to diminish that at all. And it certainly will play a role in politics as we move forward. But it's just one of a number of strategies, you know, from this to the reaction to Dr. Seuss, these cultural wars that they fight are just a way to reaffirm their base, but not expand it necessarily.
And Frank, what do you see in terms of this tightrope that organizations have to do, or businesses have to navigate between, you know, what has become this increasingly polarized political state that we're in?
Yeah, and it's not just corporations, it's all institutions, right? I think what has happened in reaction to the movement for Black Lives, but again, to, you know, efforts to beat back democracy in our society, is that, you know, people are going to have to make choices. Institutions have to make choices. And are they going to choose to side with, you know, movements that are really trying to ensure that we actually have a democracy in our society? Or are they going to ally themselves with the fascistic elements? And I don't use that word loosely, right? And so that's what makes this moment fascinating. As a scholar, right? I'm a scholar of social movements and in U.S. history. Is to see that yet again, we seem to be in a, you know, I hate to use this overused word, an unprecedented moment in U.S. politics, yeah, in a lot of ways. And I think that's going to be the predicament that, you know, every institution is facing, from, you know, corporate interests to universities like where I work at. We're in the moment of a great, you know, reckoning, and it's going to be interesting to see how this will transpire.
Okay. Nicholas Pierce is a clinical professor of management and organizations at Northwestern University's Kellogg School of Management. And Frank Garrity is an associate professor of history at Columbia University. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Last week, Secretary of the Interior Deb Haaland announced the creation of a new unit to coordinate between federal agencies on cases involving missing and murdered Indigenous women. According to the Urban Indian Health Institute, while there were nearly 6,000 Indigenous women and girls reported missing in 2016, the Department of Justice only included 116 of those cases in their federal missing persons database. The failure of law enforcement to pursue many of these cases is an issue Secretary Haaland has been outspoken on throughout her career. Here she is at a House subcommittee hearing in 2019.
The silent crisis of missing and murdered Indigenous women has been my top priority since long before being sworn into Congress, and I am appreciative that I'm here today to hear your testimony to help find solutions to this long overdue issue in Indian country.
But the new unit created by Secretary Holland is not the first time the federal government has taken steps to address the issue of missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls. Here with me now is Sarah Deer, a professor at the University of Kansas, who focuses on the intersection of federal Indian law and victims' rights. She's also a citizen of the Muscogee Creek Nation. Sarah, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So what do you think of Secretary Holland's announcement about the new unit?
Well, as somebody who focuses on violence against Native women, of course, I'm thrilled to see any effort to take this issue at the very top level. And I think that because of her leadership, there's a chance we could really see some changes on the ground.
How important is interagency communication when it comes to issues involving Indian country in particular?
One of the biggest challenges I talk about, and this is general, it's not just specific to crime, but tribal nations have to contend with three separate federal agencies to meet the needs that these various tribes have. So on the one hand, you have the Department of Interior, of course. We have the Department of Justice. And then we also have the Health and Human Services Department, which provides health care to Native people. And the problem has been that while all three agencies certainly have the best of intentions, sometimes they enact very different policies. And so that makes it very difficult for tribal nations to know how to navigate three separate federal agencies on a day-to-day basis.
There was a Department of Justice task force created under former President Trump to look into this issue. How much did that task force accomplish, in your opinion?
Well, I think the challenge with Trump's effort was that he issued, essentially executive orders to create task forces to do research on the issue. And, we've had a lot of research on this issue. We can always use more. But President Trump's version of this effort didn't come with any money. And it was largely a volunteer effort limited to 1 year. And we need a lot more boots on the ground in terms of solving this problem long term.
And what are some of the main gaps that do exist when trying to get these law enforcement agencies to properly investigate these cases?
What we hear from families sometimes is that they report a loved one missing and a law enforcement officer comes to take a report and finds out that she's suffered with addiction issues. She's recently lost custody of her child. And so they oftentimes don't fully investigate those. We also have challenges with cold cases, so unsolved murders. And we don't necessarily have people on the ground who are actively investigating those cold cases.
So, Sarah, you've spent a lot of your career writing about domestic violence and sexual assault against Native women. How much attention have federal law enforcement agencies placed on those crimes in the past?
Well, we've definitely had similar problems with responding to domestic violence and sexual assault. And frankly, those crimes are much more common than murder or, missing persons. And so I would love to see the same amount of effort turned towards just violence against Native people generally. I think the missing and murdered issue is getting a lot of attention right now because everyone can sort of relate to what would you do if a family were to go missing. And yet we still are very underfunded in responding to more common crimes like domestic violence and sexual assault, which of course can lead to homicide or to missing persons.
And so do you think that this would require federal involvement of this at the same level to address sexual harassment or domestic violence?
Yes, definitely. And of course, you have to remember that there's over 570 federally recognized tribes, and there isn't going to be one policy that's going to fit for all 500 tribes. We have very small tribes. We have very large tribes. So one of the challenges is to work with the federal system to not create a one-size-fits-all policy or program, but rather a methodology for helping tribal nations find the best solution for their own communities.
Are there concerns among tribal members that a more involved federal approach could lead to over-policing of Native people?
Absolutely. One of the challenges that we have is per capita, Native people are much more likely to be victims and much more likely to be involved in the criminal justice system as perpetrators. And so anytime you start to think, especially in this day and time, when you start to think about hiring more law enforcement officers, you know, definitely there's pushback from a variety of different angles. But what we have to understand is that some of our tribes might be the size of the state of Connecticut, and yet they can only afford two patrol officers at any given time. And so, you know, under-policing is actually a problem in Indian country. Again, not everywhere. And we just need to make sure that if someone calls for help, that we have somebody who can respond, whether that's a police officer or a social worker or someone trained with mental health intervention, crisis training. It doesn't have to be police, but we do need someone to respond to these cases.
What would you suggest in terms of a more effective law enforcement response? I mean, obviously, it sounds like more officers on the ground, but what other kinds of interventions are needed?
Well, I think we need to more carefully categorize Native women in any kind of data collection. So oftentimes, you know, there may be a checklist. A law enforcement officer may need to check the race of the person missing, and it only says sort of, you know, white, Black, Asian, Hispanic. And oftentimes there's no box for American Indian, Native American, or Alaska Native. And so when we start entering those cases into any sort of database, we may not be even collecting the data about Native cases or about Native women going missing.
Sarah Deer is a professor at the University of Kansas and a citizen of the Muscogee Creek Nation. Thanks so much, Sarah.
Thank you for having me.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing. Or
politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.
In 2015, after the killing of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, the city of St. Louis established a civilian oversight board to review investigations of officer-involved shootings. The board was supposed to serve as an independent body to review investigations and determine steps forward. But since the board was established, the St. Louis Metropolitan Police Department has never turned over any materials to review an officer-involved shooting case. Compared with other cities, the St. Louis Police Department leads the nation in killings by police officers, worrying activists about the lack of oversight the civilian board has. Joining us to help break this down is Champ Barton, a reporter with The Trace. Champ, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So walk us through how the Civilian Oversight Board works. What's the process supposed to look like?
Absolutely. So the Civilian Oversight Board in St. Louis has several responsibilities, not just reviewing officer-involved shooting investigations. More broadly, their goal is to review internal affairs investigations and any allegations of police misconduct to provide sort of an independent check on police. The officer-involved shooting investigations that the Civilian Oversight Board reviews, though, follow a specific process that other forms of police misconduct complaints do not follow. And it's pretty convoluted and lengthy. These investigations begin at the police department. So there is a special division that was set up actually in 2014 after the killing of Michael Brown, that was incorporated into this process when the Civilian Oversight Board was established, called the Force Investigation Unit. And after every officer involved shooting, this unit conducts its own investigation, essentially gathering evidence about what happened during the shooting. They compile that evidence and they send a report to the circuit attorney's office. And that evidence is supposed to help the circuit attorney decide whether or not she wants to charge the officer criminally for his or her behavior in this situation. Once the circuit attorney makes a charging decision, that report is sent over to Internal Affairs. Internal Affairs conducts its own investigation, this time looking for violations of department protocol that the officer may have participated in. And then after the Internal Affairs concludes its investigation, that information gets sent off to a congregation of high-ranking police officials within the department called the Deadly Force Tactical Review Board. And that board is supposed to essentially review the findings of the investigation thus far and make any determination about whether or not department procedure needs to be tweaked to prevent certain things from happening in the field. It's only after all that happens that the police commissioner can then sign off on the investigation thus far and send it over to the Civilian Oversight Board.
And so is it that last step where things are breaking down?
So people aren't 100% sure where this process is breaking down, but the suspicion that I heard most frequently in my reporting was that it was actually breaking down in a handoff between the Force Investigation Unit and the Circuit Attorney's Office. So essentially, many people, activists in the city, think that there is a hang up on that point of the process, either with the Force Investigation Unit's investigations or with the Circuit Attorney's Office charging decisions. So there has been some public back and forth between these two entities in the past about these investigations. And the Circuit Attorney's Office has basically said in the past that the investigations that they were getting from the Force Investigation Unit were sort of incomplete, were not as thorough as they needed to be, which was preventing the Circuit Attorney from being able to make a thorough and responsible charging decision in these cases. And the Circuit Attorney has like put together her own team of investigators in the past that now kind of does a parallel investigation to the Force Investigation Unit, but she is still primarily reliant on the Force Investigation Unit's report in order to make a charging decision in each of these cases. So the police department, on the other hand, has sort of implied that the circuit attorney is sort of dragging her feet when it comes to making these charging decisions. So when I asked the police department where these cases had ended up or where they were at, what stage they were at in this process, they told me that every officer-involved shooting that the Force Investigation Unit has reviewed has been sent over to the circuit attorney's office, which would imply that if these investigations haven't been completed yet, that the circuit attorney's office has just not made their charging decision, which has prevented the process from moving forward. However, there's no confirmation about whether or not all of these cases have made it through the circuit attorney's office and are now stuck in internal affairs, or if they're stuck at the Deadly Force Tactical Review Board, or if the police commissioner is holding on to them. It's really hard to tell. And at the present moment, we just don't really know. The circuit attorney did not get back to me in time for the story, so I wasn't able to confirm whether or not she had made charging decisions in a majority of these cases.
What is a circuit attorney exactly?
So the circuit attorney is essentially one of the chief prosecutors in St. Louis. And her job is essentially to decide whether or not to prosecute these officers criminally for any of their conduct on the force.
And so what are the activists and families in St. Louis saying about what they want in terms of how to fix this process, which clearly isn't working?
Yeah, it's hard to say. I mean, there isn't a unanimous agreement about how to solve this problem. Some activists that I spoke with in the city have long campaigned for the Civilian Oversight Board to be moved out of the Department of Public Safety in St. Louis. So as it exists presently, the Department of Public Safety oversees both the police department and the Civilian Oversight Board, which some activists are uncomfortable with. They feel like that's too close to the police department, that the person that is overseeing civilian oversight is also has this stake in the police department and that it creates conflicts of interest. And so they would like for the Civilian Oversight Board to be removed outside of the Department of Public Safety and given its own agency that is sort of run by civilians. Now, it's not clear how that process would change the review process itself. And so other than that, no one has really had an idea of how to speed up the review process, mostly because we just don't really know at what stage of the sort of civilian review process these investigations are getting hung up. However, the sort of bottom line, and like you said, this isn't this process just isn't working. It's not providing the transparency it was intended to provide. And the families of police victims, or police shooting victims rather, and other victims of police violence are sort of left in a difficult position because this civilian oversight board was designed to provide them some sort of closure or comfort that the investigation of police misconduct or police violence would have this civilian check, that you would have a non-police agency that could examine the behavior of the department and decide whether or not that behavior was responsible. At the present moment, that just isn't happening in officer-involved shootings, which are sort of the highest profile and most dramatic instances of police violence. You know, one family member that I spoke to who had lost his brother in 2013 to a police shooting described it to me basically like leaving an open wound, that they just are unable to close because they are constantly sort of skeptical of whether or not the police conducted themselves appropriately.
Champ Barton is a reporter with The Trace. Champ, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
After a year of isolation, wearing masks and staying 6 feet apart, our brains, like most everything else, have adapted to the COVID-19 pandemic. They've had to rewire themselves to deal with the stress and monotony of pandemic life. And for some of us, that's led to serious brain fog. Whether that's meant forgetting the names of acquaintances, or getting easily distracted. You told us about it.
Hi, this is Lee from North Bergen, and heck yeah, I've experienced brain fog over the past year. I've been struggling to find the words I'm looking for in simple conversation, had trouble focusing when reading, put things away in crazy spots, phone in the freezer, and even had to start making lists for just about everything because I can't seem to hold on to things lately.
Hey friends, it's The Takeaway. This is Lauren in Washington, D.C. I think that I've definitely hit my dropout point. I know we've all pretty much slammed into that pandemic wall with various malaises and fogs and all of that kind of stuff. Mine has impacted me where I basically am working from home and I get up from my desk and I walk into a different room and I have no idea why I'm there. Like, what am I doing? My dog follows me in and is like staring at me, you know, like, are you here for something? And I have no clue. Like, what am I doing in this bedroom? And I'm just totally fuzzy in my brain.
Unfortunately, I know too well what brain fog feels like. So I wanted to hear from an expert about what's really happening to our brains right now and how long this might last. Dr. Molly Colvin is a developmental neuropsychologist and assistant professor of psychology at Harvard Medical School. And here's how she described this so-called brain fog.
I think of brain fog as being a change in the way that you're thinking that primarily relates to attention and memory. So people often tell me that they have a hard time focusing or they're more easily distracted. They might start something and then forget to finish it because they start to do something else. They might miss a meeting or an appointment and suddenly realize it a couple hours later, or even have trouble coming up with names or words that are super familiar, but you just can't quite get to it as quickly as you once did.
Let's talk about why the pandemic is triggering this impairment with our cognitive functioning.
Brain fog, as you've pointed out, can happen over the course of our lifetimes in the absence of really any major sort of brain trauma. And so I think of it as, you know, a normal response sometimes to stress. When you encounter anything that's sort of threatening, your brain really goes into overdrive and focuses its attention and energy on the thing that is threatening to make sure that it won't hurt you and so that you can also try to get away from it. From an evolutionary perspective, the stress response evolved to help us cope with predators in the wild. So, you know, if there's a tiger on the path ahead of you, then you need to focus all your attention on that tiger and get away from it. And in the case of the pandemic, the threat hasn't been a tiger. It's been this invisible virus that has now killed more than 500,000 Americans. And so, of course, we've all been worried about the virus hurting us or a loved one. And your body has likely released some stress hormones and adrenaline that change the way that our brains and bodies work so that we're really hyper-responsive to signals about that threat. It really changes the way that those attentional resources get deployed in our day-to-day world.
I'm really surprised to hear you say that, actually, because if I had tried to predict what your answer would be, I would have expected it to be more about the monotony and the closing of our world down to one little place. That would have been my guess. Is that part of this at all as well?
The scope of our worlds has kind of come down into a smaller environment. But if you also think about what that has entailed, it's been a significant amount of change. So especially the early days of the pandemic, you know, many of us were really adjusting to a whole lot of transitions at once. You know, if you think about kind of any other stressful times in your life, like when you've moved or changed jobs or had a baby or grieved the loss of a loved one, anytime you're going through those transitions, you can't go as much on automatic pilot. You kind of have to think a little bit more and establish new routines. And I think one of the things that's made this pandemic so hard for many of us is that those major life events have been layered on top of the already sort of stressful situation of living through the pandemic. It's almost like the existential threat of the virus has sort of been running in the background, taking up resources. So in some ways, it's, you know, no pun intended, a little bit like a virus on a hard drive, where it sort of runs in the background and we're not even aware of it all the time, but it's taking up energy and resources.
So some people have contracted COVID-19 and experienced brain fog as a side effect of that. But what we're talking about here is the effects on the brain experienced by everyone right now, not just people who have contracted COVID-19. What are some of the key differences between those two different things going on?
The way that we're talking about brain fog right now is as a normal stress response, as part of a normal stress response. But the term sort of brain fog and some of these cognitive changes that we're talking about are often also the same kind of cognitive changes that people have been talking about in long-haul COVID. So people who've had COVID who are now describing cognitive changes. But they also are things that can be seen in other medical conditions. So sometimes I hear patients talk about this after they've had chemotherapy, or they may be having early symptoms of a neurodegenerative disease like Alzheimer's. So that's a situation where you can experience some of these same kinds of symptoms, and they shouldn't be ignored if you've got other underlying conditions. But, you know, for most of us, these kinds of everyday blips on our radar screen is kind of the way I think about it, is likely really to be an indicator that we're under stress and that it's time to listen to our bodies and our minds and maybe focus on things that matter, like our health and that of our loved ones.
Are there going to be any long-term effects of this? I mean, what should we expect even once life returns to what we hope will be close to normal?
Going through this pandemic has been traumatic. It's hard to find anyone who hasn't been touched in a significant way by this. And I think that kind of collective trauma is going to be something that we carry with us. But, you know, I think that what we can also expect is that there should be some recovery as the stress level declines. And I think importantly, as our, you know, worlds start to open back up again, one of the most sort of powerful balms for brain fog and for stress in general is social connectedness. And that's something that we've all had a hard time maintaining over the course of the last year, even in sort of a real way. I think it will be perhaps a longer recovery than some of us may anticipate. And it's important to be compassionate and kind to ourselves as we go through it.
In addition to social connectedness, are there other things that we can be doing to help push through or cope with the brain fog?
Some of the things that are most important around managing stress in general, we all kind of know that they're hard to implement, but they're the things related to self-care. So making sure that you're on a normal sleeping routine and exercising. And I think also focusing on the things that you can control. I think many of us have probably heard the term mindfulness, which is really about being in the here and the now and being aware of your environment. So taking a big deep breath and noticing how that feels in your body, or listening now that it's spring to the birds chirp, or noticing the flowers that on your sidewalk. Those are the kinds of things that can bring your attention away from the things that are stressful and into the present moment. And we know that if you can stay rooted in that sort of present moment, it often will allow your mind to relax a little bit and your body to relax as well.
Dr. Molly Colvin is a developmental neuropsychologist and assistant professor of psychology at Harvard Medical School. Dr. Colvin, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you again for having me. It's been a pleasure.
I have experienced brain fog over the last year, which I knew when it was happening was related to being very stressed. I then began to seriously undertake the practice of meditation and doing things to lower my stress, which then seemed to put an end to the brain fogs. I've learned to be a lot more patient than I already was, a lot more flexible than I already was, because there is so much happening and so much where you are trying to take control just of yourself, because your external environment is out of your control in this pandemic.
Brain fog? Yeah. Let's just say that we could have an easy half-hour segment talking about this, how brain fog has manifested for me over the last year, day-to-day, with all this COVID insanity we've all been dealing with. Yeah, it's not been fun. It's definitely not been enjoyable. By the way, this is Steve from the Denton, Texas area again.
This is Katrina from Maplewood, New Jersey. Brain fog, like keys in the refrigerator? Not yet, but days of the week, months, seasons, where my shoes are, what my children are doing, there are days when I just can't figure it all out.
Have I experienced brain fog over the last year? Yes. Lots of fog. My to-do list used to have just a few items to roll over to the next day. Now it's more than half. Things do seem to be a bit busier, yes, but part of it is certainly due to not being able to get done what I felt like I could before. Fog is a factor. Is this a pent-up pandemic thing? Is it a getting older thing? Is it a health-related thing or something else I haven't thought of?
Hi, it's Sienna. I have had fibromyalgia and ADHD for several years, so I already had brain fog pretty bad. But since COVID, I've had to learn so many new things. I'm a pastor, and we've had to learn so much about how to continue on in the age of COVID. And there's just been workshops and classes and videos and everything to constantly try to figure out what we're supposed to be doing. My head is just jam-packed with new information. And so I just have been experiencing brain fog to the extent that it has really messed with my productivity, my organization. I about half the time don't know which direction to turn from one minute to another. And so this has been a really difficult time for me.
This is Dee Dee from San Francisco. I find that these days I seem to be very forgetful, but thanks to my phone, my task list app on it, and Google, I'm able to remember almost everything, as long as I can remember where I put my phone.
Okay, people, a lot of information today. We hope you got to take it in, or most of it. Back with you tomorrow. I'm Nancy Solomon in for Tanzina Vega this week, and this is The Takeaway.